This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Lots of kids dream of playing in the NBA. For Blondie Baruti, it was a long-distance dream with obstacles aplenty. One day when he was 9 years old, Blondie woke to chaos and his mother's frantic shouts.
She was like, we gotta go, like, now. And I was trying to pack. She was like, no, we cannot pack. We have to leave now.
Did you have a sense then what you were running from?
I had no idea. You know, I just saw AK-47 guns and bombs just blasting everywhere and people falling down, and we just keep on running again and again.
In 2000, the Democratic Republic of Congo was filled with families running as hard as Blondie's. His father had left when Blondie was 3. Blondie, his older sister, and their mother had been living in Goma in the eastern part of Congo. On the day they fled, as Baruti put it, the war finally reached our backyard. He didn't know whether that war was part of the on-again, off-again civil conflict in Congo or a battle that had spilled over from neighboring Rwanda. He had no time to ask. He and his sister and his mother ran into the jungle.
And there's a lot of kids who didn't make it. You know, a lot of kids who died on the road because of diseases, and there was famine, no food for days. And also there's like a lot of snakes. You never know which one can bite you.
The plan was to walk to Kisangani, just over 400 miles away. On some days, they made progress. On other days, they huddled in the jungle and hoped the armed men they could hear around them wouldn't find them.
I used to cry all the time. There's no food, there's no clean water, and you're sleeping on the ground and in the middle of nowhere, it's dark. You can't even set up fire, because if you set up fire, you're afraid like rebels might see you guys and kill you guys. And then after a while, it become normal. It became normal to me.
Kisangani might have seemed like a safe destination when the family started running, but by the time they got there, it was just another city to flee. Perseverance, more hungry trekking, begging, and a lot of luck eventually brought them to a boat that took them to Kinshasa, nearly 1,600 miles from Kisangani. There, Blondie Baruti found stability, at least compared to what he'd endured to get there. He went to school. There was even time for sports, which, for Blondie, for a time, meant soccer.
I was too tall to keep playing soccer. I was very, very tall. And my friend was like, you need to start learning how to play basketball because this is not for you. You're good, but you're just way too tall for this.
Despite days when he had only one meal and some days when he had none, Blondie Baruti would grow to be 6'8".
And after a while, I started using it as a motivation. I know one day I'm going to go to the U.S. I'm going to go to the U.S. and I'm going to play college basketball and I'm going to make great things happen.
Blondie's devotion to basketball wasn't quite absolute. He was also the tallest guy in the school's theater company.
The main reason why I started to act, it was because there was a girl, Peggy. She was so beautiful and I wanted to tell her, like, you are beautiful, but I was so scared. And she was an actress at my school, so I was like, okay, I want you to learn how to act. And thank God, they made me her husband play. I even asked our teacher, like, can you make a scene where I can kiss her? She was like, no.
The basketball dream was even more unlikely than the dream of kissing Peggy. Dikembe Mutombo made it to Georgetown University and the NBA, but quick, name another guy from Congo who's done it. Still, a big guy who can play draws attention, even in Kinshasa. Blondie was eventually approached by a man who had some connections to private secondary schools in the U.S., a reasonable option since Blondie was perhaps not ready for college there. He spoke no English. But soon Blondie's older cousin entered the picture. This was Patrick. He lived in the U.S., and he announced that he would manage the prospect's career. Patrick found a family in Mesa, Arizona, Terry and Lori Blitz, willing to put up both of them, and then began trying to secure his own future.
Because when I first moved there, my cousin used to tell me, do not trust these white people because they don't love you. Everything they're doing for you, they are running it down. So one day when you make it to the NBA, they're going to make a lot of money off of you.
Patrick, who'd misrepresented himself as a successful businessman, was more like a speculator. He'd hoped to profit from Blondie's basketball success. He'd become the legal guardian, which meant that until Blondie was an adult, he couldn't officially get free of Patrick. At an age when lots of U.S. students are starting college, Blondie slowly began getting accustomed to course requirements and basketball in the public school in Mesa. Pretty quickly, the warning to trust his blood relative rather than Terry and Lori began to make less sense. According to Blondie, Cousin Patrick was sleeping until noon and freeloading off the blitzes, while Terry and Lori were treating Blondie like a member of the family.
She would take me to class before she'd go to work. They would pick me up. They would buy me food. They would buy me clothes. They would make sure I do my homework. Terry would get on me about not practicing hard. And then I start feel more comfortable being around them than being around my cousin.
Terry and Lori Blitz had made sure Blondie was prepared to take advantage of the basketball scholarship he got from the University of Tulsa. But in just his second season there, Blondie suffered a serious ankle injury.
It was just so much pain. But I was trying to hold on to the hope, like, I'm going to make it to the NBA. And I was like, no, this is all I got. If I can survive war in the Congo, yes, I can survive this injury. You know, I walk about 500 miles through the jungle of the Congo. I play, you know, bare feet in the Congo in 110 degrees outside. Nothing like this happened to me. So why this injury now?
That question had no answer. But the question of whether Blondie Baroudi would ever play pro basketball did have one. It was provided by the doctor who treated Blondie.
He was like, you just gotta let it go because it's not gonna get any better. I collapsed in his office. He started crying. I felt like basketball was my way to help my mom, to help my sister, to help my family back home. But I had to let it go, and I had to move on.
Where does a 6'8 basketball player move to when he's told to let basketball go? Blondie had enjoyed the acting he'd done in school, even though he hadn't gotten to kiss Peggy. Like basketball players, actors got rich. If he succeeded, he could help his family in Congo. 2 days after graduation at Tulsa, he was off to L.A.
I had faith. I was like, I'm going to go out there, I'm going to become an actor, and I'm going to be in a movie.
Blondie's efforts followed a plot line familiar to lots of aspiring movie stars. His meager funds ran out. He borrowed from everybody he knew. He slept in his car, and then he went back to Terry and Lori in Mesa. He might be in Arizona to this day if he hadn't heard about a TV pilot that needed a tall African basketball player who didn't have to speak much English. Terry and Lori funded his return to L.A., and eventually Blondie got the part. Though the show wasn't picked up, he eventually parlayed the experience into an opportunity to play a baddie named Hutar in Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. It was a tiny role. His makeup and costume rendered him unrecognizable, but he was at the premiere.
It was probably one of the best feelings I ever had in my life. You know, like just to be around all these actors. You know, I always heard of Stallone, Chris Pratt. I was like, from the Congo, from the jungle of the Congo to being the premiere of Guardians of the Galaxy. I just could not believe it. And I was this close to jump. That's me, America. That's me. But you're like, no. You can't. You gotta stay quiet.
With assistance, Blondie Baroudi has written a screenplay about his life and another one about a boxer from Congo whose career trajectory seems oddly familiar. He sees himself as the star,
like Sylvester Stallone did with Rocky. He wrote something for himself. That's how he got in.
Yep, that's how he did it, and he's nowhere near 6'8". Good luck, champ. It's time for three stories you should know. Believe it or not, we are already about a quarter of the way through the Major League Baseball season, and we're going to start this week by talking about a team that already has achieved about a 0.0% chance of making the playoffs at the end of that regular season. I'm joined by MLB national correspondent Will Leach via Skype and by Michael Holly. He's a host at NBC Sports Boston. Welcome to both of you.
Hello, sir.
Bill, good to see you again.
Will, tell us of this hapless team.
So for 13 years, from 1998 to 2011, the Baltimore Orioles did not have a single winning season. But in 2012, it changed thanks to Buck Showalter and Manny Machado and Adam Jones, some relievers, and a healthy smattering of good luck. For 5 years, the Orioles had the best record in the American League, and they reached the playoffs 3 times. So congrats, Orioles fans. Your patience was rewarded. Well, no. Actually, their reward was postseason disappointment, which is a very different kind of disappointment, and they never reached a World Series. And now even that good time is over. The Orioles are 17 games under 500, which is super bad when you've only played 37 games, by the way. And they are done. The Orioles have to bottom out again, this time with no Buck and no Machado, but the same management group that got them into this mess. And honestly, if you really look at it objectively, the Orioles are likely going to be bad for another 13 years. My friend here in Athens, he's actually considering making his kids Braves fans. Sports bigamy, a crime I believe is punishable by the guillotine.
Michael, do you share Will's despair?
Yes. I mean, how could you not? I mean, they are awful. They have one great player in Manny Machado who's going to be traded or is going to leave via free agency. But, I don't know, bottom out for a couple of years, stockpile some good draft picks if they know how to draft well. And they'll be back, Will, I wouldn't say 10 years. How about five?
I'm going to join you in that optimistic view because I don't think in this day and age we can say with confidence that any team is going to stay bad for decades. I like to be optimistic about all teams, even as late as the middle of May.
And Will mentioned the Astros. I mean, how long were the Astros bad before they won last year? I mean, it wasn't 10 years. They had a plan. I think it was like they had the proverbial five-year plan. and I think they actually fulfilled it.
So, Will, are you at all encouraged by this, or do you remain in? And is this friend of yours, is this like when you go to the doctor or call the doctor and say, a friend of mine has a pimple in an embarrassing place, I'm just asking for a friend? Or
I'm a Cardinals fan, so this is purely out of empathy.
Right.
So I will assure you, though, that every Orioles fan listening to this is listening to the two of you and go, they just don't understand. They just don't understand. And I have to say, I've come around to their way of thinking.
All right, Michael, you're going to move us along to a game in which the decision maker does not just sit on a bench and chew sunflower seeds, and that would be basketball.
In basketball, I want to talk about Brad Stevens, the head coach, the youthful head coach of the Boston Celtics. They were able to hire him after Doc Rivers decided that he didn't want to go through a rebuilding project with the Celtics. So he went to the Los Angeles Clippers, and the Celtics went to Butler University in Indiana and hired Brad Stevens. Most of the cliches out there about NBA coaches are that, well, the coaches are there along for the ride, and it's a players' league. And that cliche existed for a reason because it was true. Even Phil Jackson winning six championships with Michael Jordan, we focus more on Phil Jackson's Zen methods, and he had a triangle.
He gave everybody a book.
He gave everybody books, and he was the whisperer. But we didn't talk much about Phil Jackson's acumen as a basketball coach. But with Brad Stevens, there's a change happening, not only with players and general managers, but also fans are starting to recognize some of the things that Brad Stevens is doing to get the Celtics in the position they're in right now, which is in the Eastern Conference Finals, without two of their best players. Not only two of their best players, their two best players.
Will, is Michael giving Brad Stevens too much credit?
Well, I will say that he's giving him more credit than his fellow NBA coaches, who, in fact, did not actually get a single vote for Coach of the Year. And
right.
I think part of that is because Stevens is relatively new to the NBA. So he was a butler. He's seen almost as if, like, the way everyone at my mother's Catholic church saw her because she converted late in life. And they're like, hey, oh, look at you. You just got here.
Look at you.
Yeah, exactly. But I also think that, like, look at another coach that's having a great year is Mike D'Antoni at Houston. Mike D'Antoni, if you actually watch a D'Antoni game, it's basically the same three plays over and over and over, but they have the right people to make it work. So to me, what I find interesting about Stevens is he's obviously doing a great job, but he seems to be doing a great job in a very different way than other NBA coaches also do great jobs.
The Coach of the Year thing is an interesting matter to discuss. It seems to me that the point of the NBA season is to win the championship, and the secondary point, or perhaps first, is to make a lot of money. And so the Coach of the Year should be either the guy whose team wins the NBA championship or the guy who coaches the team that makes the most money. And you can take your pick, depending on your view of how America works. But Brad Stevens, it does seem to me that he's done something rather remarkable, Michael, as you pointed out. I would have voted for him.
Yeah.
I live here in Boston, and so my vote wouldn't have counted.
Yeah, I am curious why he didn't get a vote. Doc Rivers, who I mentioned earlier, his team finished 42-40 and did not make the playoffs. and he got a vote. So I'm wondering, you're not allowed to vote for yourself. So I don't know how you got it. But, you know, Will's example of Houston is a good one. But can I give you the Coach of the Year title if you have that much talent on your side?
Yeah, that means that you're such a good coach that you know how to stay out of the way. Yeah.
This is why Bill's the best host. That's Bill's the best host because he has all of this talent.
All right, I'm going to take the final topic this week, and I apologize in advance because I don't think there's going to be any controversy on this one, but who knows? I've been surprised before. Attention has to be paid to a fellow named Alex Lyon. This is a guy who was playing goalie for the Lehigh Valley Phantoms of the AHL when his team won Game 4 in a playoff series for the Calder Cup the other night. He made 94 saves. The game ended in the fifth overtime, took more than 6 hours to play, slipped over into the next day, ended at 1-something in the morning. He stopped the last 79 shots he saw to preserve the win. Some goalies don't make 94 saves in a month. I gotta say, please join me in saluting Mr. Lyon.
I am with you. The only thing you can knock him for, and this might be nitpicking, the only thing you can knock him for is that he's still 4 shy of the all-time AHL record, which is 98. So sorry. Hey, if you're going to have a night like that, going over 2 days, set the record. But no, in all seriousness, great accomplishment. And I think there were more than 5,000 people at the game at the start of it. At the end, probably
11.
Family and friends.
Right, exactly.
Listen, the only reason he was able to get 94 saves is because he gave up a goal in the second period that allowed overtime to go anyway, okay? So listen, is this what America is coming to? That we are celebrating failures that allow great... Yeah, of course, it's amazing. I'm just kidding. It's really amazing. It's an absolutely amazing thing. I can't even get on skates without falling down. The whole thing looks like a magic trick to me.
I do appreciate your trying to create
controversy. I tried to go Bayless on
it. In this portion of the program anyway. My guest for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know has been Michael Holly. He's a host at NBC Sports Boston, and Will Leach, MLB national correspondent. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you, Bill.
As always, an honor.
6 years ago, Victoria Grover traveled from Maine to Utah to go hiking.
I don't know if ecstasy is the right word, but I was just really, really happy. It had been so many years since I'd been able to do anything like that. I felt like I was flying.
That feeling wouldn't last. That's coming up on Only a Game from NPR.
Planet Money tip number 17. Sometimes life is exactly like the movies.
T-minus 30 seconds.
They said T-minus. They said T-minus.
Planet Money, a podcast about the economy and sometimes about rocket ships.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Which is more difficult, surviving alone in the wilderness or returning to civilization? Victoria Grover has experienced both, and she says sometimes civilization can be tough. Christina Sorensen has the story.
Victoria Grover has always loved being out in the wilderness, but she's learned a rule about making mistakes.
You get 3 mistakes. The first mistake, you're probably going to recover from that and everything's going to be fine. The second mistake, it's a little bit more difficult. The third mistake kills you.
6 years ago, Victoria traveled from her home in northern Maine to southern Utah to do some hiking. For this busy 59-year-old physician assistant, this was going to be a well-earned vacation. On her first day, a Monday in April, she found an interesting trail on a map, and she went down to the front desk at her guest lodge to ask for directions to the trailhead.
The last thing I said to him was that I'm going to be going and I'll be back no later than 8 or 9 o'clock. And I think I asked him to if there was any supper, if they could hold it for me. But and he said, yes, they could do that. And I looked him in the eye and said, so I'll see you tonight. And he said, fine. And I left.
Victoria drove down a road called Hell's Backbone. And soon she was exploring the red rock cliffs and canyons of the Box Death Hollow Wilderness.
I don't know if ecstasy is the right word, but I was just really, really happy. It had been so many years since I'd been there and so many years since I'd been able to do anything like that. And so I felt like I was flying down that trail. And I got down the trail and then I kind of went up more into the hills and I got higher up. I was so happy. And all of a sudden, I noticed that it was getting dark.
Victoria immediately started heading back for her car, but before long, she had to pull out a small flashlight she carried in her emergency kit.
as it got darker, that little flashlight was just pathetic. And I got more and more frantic because I did not want to have people come looking for me. And so I just kept going faster and faster. And I slipped at one point and skidded about 3 or 4 feet down towards a 20 or 30 foot cliff. And that was the point when I stopped and I sat down and I said, "You're going to die of stupidity if you keep going tonight." And I said, "I guess I'm spending the night here."
40 years earlier, when she was 19, Victoria had taken a month-long wilderness survival course in this same area. So although she felt bad that the hotel staff would be worried about her, she knew she could take care of herself.
And of course, nobody's made a fire out there in a million years, so there was lots of dead wood, and I had a very nice fire and watched the stars and listened to coyotes and had a nice night. It got quite cold, but the fire was really good, and I kept it going all night.
As soon as the sun came up the next morning, Victoria headed back toward her car.
So I started going down. I picked out what I thought was a good, safe route to go down. It was a series of little ledges into a bowl. It had been a waterfall at some point anciently. So what I was doing was throwing my gear over the edge and then lowering myself down over each little 4 or 5 foot thing.
She did fine until the very last ledge. But on that one, as she dropped to the ground, she lost her balance.
And I fell sideways, and my left leg hit a rock that was just angled at the right angle to shatter the bones in my left lower leg in several places. And I looked at my leg, and my knee was facing up, but my foot was lying on its left side on the ground. And I thought to myself, "Oh, I have a tib-fib fracture."
As a physician assistant, Victoria was more than qualified to diagnose her own injury.
And the next thing I thought was, well, at least they're already looking for me. And then the thing I thought after that was, that's my second mistake.
Victoria knew she was in trouble. This was a bad injury, and there was no way she was getting out on her own power now. She fashioned a splint for her leg and then started making as much noise as she could.
I yelled 3 times. I had rocks I would bang 3 times. I didn't have a whistle, but I had other, you know, I'm a pretty good yeller. And I did that all day.
By late afternoon, Victoria realized she could be on her own for another night. She started dragging and scooting herself toward a stream and got there just as the sun was going down. That gave her access to water. But with night coming on, she had another problem. The temperatures were near freezing, and the only thing she had for warmth was a dollar store poncho. She discovered if she wrapped it over her head, she could capture some of the warmth from her own breath.
About every 5 or 8 minutes, I had to take the poncho off, and because there was so much condensation inside, I had to take the poncho off and shake it, and then I would turn it inside out, and then I would wrap myself all up in it. But that was my night.
The next day was Wednesday. Victoria had told the lodge she'd be back on Monday night, so she figured by now they'd have alerted the authorities and have a full search team out looking for her. She napped when she could, and the rest of the time she continued yelling and banging on rocks. But the hours passed, and again by evening there was no sign of anyone. She was hungry and cold, but then that night it started to rain.
And then after a while, I realized that the flowers all around me were blooming because it smelled really good. So in the desert, the plants bloom at night in the dark, and they do it only after it rains. And it just smelled for about 2 hours. The smell was so wonderful. So Thursday morning came, and I said, okay, so today they're going to find me. I mean, a Monday night. I told them I'd be back Monday night. This is Thursday.
But again, the day passed, and no one came.
That's the one evening that I remember crying, you know, and getting mad and yelling. And I just didn't want to spend one more night shivering all night. I mean, you just shiver violently. It's like jumping into a cold, icy lake and not being allowed to get out. There is no place, not one place, where you aren't excruciatingly cold. And the shivering is just as bad as the cold because it's so exhausting. It's like doing push-ups and never being allowed to stop.
Victoria made it through that night, but the next afternoon,
I realized that I had not needed to pee for a while. And I knew that was a bad sign. So I knew that what was happening was that my my kidneys were beginning to close down. And so that night, it started to get cold, and I did not start shivering. And I knew that that was bad, too. And that was the first time I said to myself that night, I said, well, maybe I'm not going to survive. You know, I still thought they were looking for me, but I was thinking maybe they're going to find a body, not a living person. And then the next morning they came.
Just in time.
Just in time. Just in the nick of time.
A search helicopter had spotted Victoria lying next to the stream. She'd been out in the elements for 5 nights by then. The searchers were amazed when she sat up and waved at them. They wrapped her up in some blankets and flew her to a local hospital.
So I called my husband and told him I was okay, and I was sorry that everybody had spent so long looking for me, that I'd inconvenienced everybody so much. And he said, no one's been looking for you. No one even knew you were missing. And that was when, emotionally, the bottom kind of fell out of my psyche.
They took her off to surgery before she could learn any more. The next morning, she woke up to the telephone ringing in her hospital room.
It was some woman calling from Anderson Cooper's office in New York saying, just in this big bubbly, oh, we've heard all about your story and we want to fly you to New York and we want you to be on television. This is so inspiring and Anderson Cooper wants to see you. And I said, I'll talk to you later.
And that was just the beginning. Reporters kept calling and she kept putting them off. She was fine taking responsibility for her own mistakes, but there was something she didn't want to talk about.
I didn't want to say, I told somebody where I was going and when I'd come back. And I have no idea why he didn't tell anybody when I didn't come back. I don't know why. And all these reporting people who were suddenly so fascinated would get a whole new story. They'd get a story about this woman almost died because this young man neglected to tell people where she had gone. Shame on him. And they would all go down all those sharks and eat him alive. And I didn't think I felt comfortable being responsible for doing something like that. So I had no idea what I was going to say. The only alternative to that story was, I was so stupid. I walked out in the desert and broke my leg, and I had never told anybody where I was going, which I've never done in my life.
The phone calls kept coming. Finally, Victoria agreed to do an interview with some local reporters. She hoped to avoid the whole topic of whether she'd told anyone her plans, and it almost worked.
So they came, and we got through an hour or so, or 45 minutes of this interview, and they asked me different stuff. But then it was finally all over, and I thought, good, I got through this. I got through this without ever having to answer the question, did you tell anybody? And so they were packing up and winding up, and the guy who was the TV station reporter, as he's packing up, he says, well, I guess you've learned your lesson. You're never going to go hiking again without telling somebody where you're going. And I was tired. It was the end of the day. And I found this particular young man very annoying when he said that, very patronizing, right? And so I kind of mumbled and said, well, next time I'm going to be more careful about who I tell. And I remember this so clearly. Everybody in the room froze. Then the TV person turned to me and he said very slowly, he said, you didn't tell anybody where you were going, did you? He said it exactly like that. And I looked at him, and there was a silence for about 10 seconds, and I said, no. And then he said, okay. They all packed up, and they left.
Several days later, Victoria was able to talk to the owner of the guest lodge, and it was only then she was able to piece together what had happened. Not long after Victoria had left on her hike, that young man she'd spoken to at the front desk finished up his shift and then left for a few days vacation. He didn't tell anyone her plans, and no one at the lodge noticed she was missing until she failed to check out on Thursday. They called the sheriff's office the next day, and that's when the search finally began. It's It's now been 6 years since Victoria was stranded out in the desert, and she's had time to think.
As time went by after that whole experience, if there was one thing that I knew I did right after coming off the desert, as ashamed as I felt, as all those feelings that you get after you've been lost and people have to rescue you, as bad as those feelings were at the time, the further I got from it so it wasn't so bad, the more glad I was that I had not sacrificed these other people for my ego's sake. I was a much happier person.
Well, so if that young man happened to be listening to this broadcast right now and you had a chance to talk to him, what would you want to say to him?
I'd say to him, I'm over it. I hope he is too. You know, he made a mistake. And fortunately, I lived through it. And, you know, it's okay. Don't agonize about it. I forgive you.
Victoria Grover is back in Maine again, running her busy medical practice and still heading for the outdoors any chance she gets.
The wilderness is safe. It's safe. It was safe then. It still feels safe now. It's civilization that's so anxiety-provoking.
That story was brought to us by reporter Christina Sorensen. Nell Scovell has written for President Obama and for The Simpsons, but she started out as a sports writer.
I think sports was a great backbone for everything I went on to do.
That's just ahead on Only a Game, and remember to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
What does it take to start something from nothing? And what does it take to actually build it? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on How I Built This, I speak with founders behind some of the most inspiring companies in the world. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up next week on Only a Game, the story of an onion that didn't stink, the one that spiced up a race against Secretariat. But now it's time for my conversation with Charlie Pierce about the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
Your dream of a Nashville-Vegas matchup in the NHL Western Conference Finals will not materialize this year anyway. The Winnipeg Jets will play the Vegas Golden Knights for the right to advance to the Stanley Cup Finals. I think I know which team you're rooting for in that one.
Oh, I'm rooting for my Las Vegas Golden Knights, obviously, although I'm very happy for the Winnipeg Jets. I mean, this was a city that lost its team, had to wait for it to get it back, and all I can say is that we're looking at a whole bunch of people who've been locked in Winnipeg all winter who get a chance to go to Las Vegas for 3 or 4 days.
And before going to Las Vegas, they went out into the street and sang "O Canada"
they
right
did.
There in Winnipeg.
They
so
could, you
lovely.
Know what? They can do that in Las Vegas and no one will notice.
In the Eastern Conference semifinals, it's the Tampa Bay Lightning against the Washington Capitals, led by one of your favorites, Alex Ovechkin. Been 20 years since the Caps made the third round, so about
well,
time.
Ovechkin had played almost 1,200 games in the NHL without making a conference finals. I'm looking forward to seeing Ovechkin on the big stage.
We are into the third round of the NBA playoffs. Golden State will face Houston in the West, and it'll be Boston and Cleveland in the East. You got a pick for us?
I think Cleveland probably will win the series, although I'm not going to bet any money on it. And I think Houston's going to get Golden State. I really do.
Kylia Carter played basketball for Ole Miss back in the 80s, and her son Wendell played basketball for Duke much more recently. Speaking before the Knight Commission on Intercollegiate Athletics on Monday, Ms. Carter compared the current NCAA basketball landscape to slavery. Did she make a convincing case?
Well, I mean, she made all the arguments we've made on this program for as long as there's been this program. I mean, maybe the slavery business is a bit of hyperbole, but she's absolutely right about the exploitation of the players, and she's absolutely right that the system is not going to survive, and the only question now is whether it's a hard or a soft landing.
Tuesday night, the Mets killed their own potential first-inning rally. Charlie, if somebody hit into a double play or miss a bunt sign?
No, they batted out of order. And
you're not supposed to do that in the major leagues.
In my years as a sports writer, I literally have never seen that in a major league game. I'm so mad I wasn't at this game.
Well, I think it's important to note that it was the manager's mistake. He filled out two lineup cards, and they were not identical. And they're supposed to be. It wasn't a case of a player jumping out of the dugout on impulse and running to the plate, which is what I was hoping.
I was really sort of hoping that. But you're right. This is the kind of thing that happens in T-ball.
Baseball brawls can be scary. Sometimes amid the pushing and shoving and milling around, somebody actually gets hurt. Maybe that's what Chris Bryant of the Cubs was trying to prevent when he broke up the brawl between his guys and the Marlins the other night by tickling Starlin Castro.
What is going on with our professional athletes? We had Brad Marchand licking opponents. Now we've got guys tickling each other.
There's no tickling in
There's
baseball.
There's no tickling in baseball.
Wayne Rooney may be coming to D.C. United this season, and if that ends up being the case, I wonder if D.C. United will suffer the same fate as Team England suffers in every World Cup.
Oh, that's cruel. But D.C. United is paying them $12 million to come over and join what is apparently becoming a retirement home for European soccer players.
Yeah, and then people in D.C. will get to sing, Wayne Rooney, Wayne Rooney, Wayne Rooney, Wayne Rooney. Kick one in for England, Wayne Rooney.
Boy, that's embarrassing.
You didn't like it?
I'm stunned.
They'll say kick one in for DC.
I'm stunned. I really am.
I learned this week, Charlie, that it's not quite true that you can bet on anything. Bet365, which is a bookmaking establishment in the UK, informed Gerard Gallagher that they would not accept his 100-pound wager that the Earth is flat. And I guess you have to admire the integrity of this particular bookmaker.
I don't understand why you wouldn't take the bet. It's a sure thing. The world is not flat.
Now, wait. You don't know what Mr. Gallagher has in terms of proof.
You know what the proof is? If you get on a boat and you sail to America, you don't fall off the edge.
It doesn't say it ends. He just says it's flat. It could be really big.
The world isn't flat, Bill!
See, the radio consultant told me controversy was a good thing. I'm trying to create one. Finally, Charlie, in a recent exhibition hockey game between amateur players and former NHL stars, one of the amateurs, a prominent politician, put on a really great exhibition. He couldn't be stopped. He scored 5 times. I guess this guy may be likely to get out of politics and sign with a pro team.
Yeah, Vladimir Putin's falling off, though. I mean, previously in these games, he scored 8 and 7 goals, respectively. This year, he only scored 5. I think it's time to put him on the expansion list. I do like the picture of him shaking hands with all the other players who are sitting there thinking, good, I can eat my dinner tonight with a clear conscience.
You know, this whole thing seems fishy to me because this is like Kim Jong-il. You know, he shot 18 for
Yeah, but nobody saw that. People actually watch people, like, get out of Vladimir's way and the goaltender jump over the net and stuff when he scores.
Which is different from standing on your head if you're a goalkeeper.
I mean, you want to put, like, polonium detectors in every room in your house? I don't.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pearson, Sports Illustrated, from time to time. And, of course, he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Nell Scovell is a champion for gender diversity in TV writers' rooms. She's got the credentials. She was one of the first women to write an episode of The Simpsons.
It was the Blowfish episode.
You have 24 hours to live.
24 hours?
Well, 22. I'm sorry I kept you waiting so long.
She's written jokes for President Obama.
Of course, there's someone who I can always count on for support. My wonderful wife, Michelle.
We made a terrific team at the Easter Egg Roll this week. I'd give out bags of candy to the kids, and she'd snatch them right back out of their little hands.
Scovell also created the TV show Sabrina the Teenage Witch and co-wrote Lean In with Sheryl Sandberg.
But it all started with me writing sports.
Here's Only a Game's Martin Kessler.
Nell Scovell's joke writing career could have ended in the third grade. It happened at a parent-teacher conference.
The teacher told my mom that I made too many jokes and asked her to please tell me to tone it down. So my mom delivers a message on my 40th birthday, literally waits 32 years to tell me that my third grade teacher had notes on my personality. But I do wonder, like, because that's the cultural bias that girls shouldn't be funny and it's unladylike. And I do wonder, boy, if she had just made me self-conscious about having a sense of humor, would that have changed everything?
Nell grew up in Newton, Massachusetts. When she wasn't entertaining her classmates, she followed the Celtics and Bruins and Red Sox. As a freshman at Harvard, she went to an intro meeting for The Crimson, the student newspaper. Editors from the news and arts and editorial boards got up and pitched the freshmen on joining their sections. And then a senior in a rumpled overcoat stood up. He was holding a cigar.
And he says, "Anyone who's cool, stick around. We're going to talk about writing sports." And I thought, I've never been cool in my life. This is my golden opportunity.
Nell says the sports board didn't make her cool, but deciding to spend her evenings in the cramped corner of the Crimson known as the Sports Cube was the right call. Quick disclosure that I, too, am an uncool but proud alum of the Crimson Sports Board. Nell became an associate sports editor, and writing for the back page of the paper gave her a chance to do something that would have been forsworn on the Crimson's more serious boards. She could be funny. She worked jokes about Play-Doh into women's soccer stories.
Well, you gotta know your audience.
During her senior year, the Boston Globe hired her to cover high school sports. On Saturday mornings, while her roommates slept in, Nell would drive to small Massachusetts towns to cover football games. But the Globe wasn't quite as game for random jokes about Greek philosophers. So after graduation, Nell moved to New York and started writing for magazines. And then one day, she ran into a former editor.
And she says to me, "Nell, I don't mean this as an insult, but I think you could write for television." And it really was the first time I ever thought about it. Because coming from the East Coast, I didn't know TV writing was a job.
It was a job. But Nell would soon realize it was one held by few women. Nell got an agent and wrote a spec script for It's Gary Shandling Show. She got a call to come to L.A.
And I go into the office and I meet Gary Shandling. And he says to me, "You write like a guy," which at the time was considered a huge compliment because guys wrote hard jokes that made you laugh out loud. And women wrote amusing lines that might make you go, "Oh, how humorous."
Nell's script for Shandling didn't end up getting made, but she started getting jobs in Hollywood. She was often the only woman in the writer's room. Nell's dream was to write for Late Night with David Letterman. At that point, the show had only employed one female writer in its history, and she was Letterman's ex-girlfriend. But in 1990, Nell got an interview.
Dave was like tossing a football in the air. He was wearing sweatpants. It was a Sports Cube vibe.
And here was Nell, who'd written for the best sports section in the country, as well as the Boston Globe. During the interview, Nell tried to prove she could fit into the boys' club. She and Letterman talked about her sports writing career and their favorite teams. The concept of culture fit was normally used to exclude women in Hollywood, but Nell had the right credentials. She got the job.
I was a good culture fit. I don't think I'm the funniest woman in the world, and I think my getting hired wasn't because I was special, but because something was really wrong there.
Sports helped Nell get into the writer's room, and now she could see what it was really like. On her first day, another writer told her, "Before this is over, I will see a tampon fall out of your purse." There were rumors that Letterman was sleeping with female staffers. Instead of speaking out, Nell just tried to blend in.
So I dressed like a guy and ate junk food like a guy.
After a few months, Nell's option at Letterman was picked up, but soon she decided she'd had enough. She left the show. Nell's years as a sports fan and writer had helped her break into Hollywood. It had prepared her to live off bad coffee and work in rooms full of men. And soon it would come in handy again. In 1998, Nell got her first directing job. She was warned that the crew might not respond well to a female director, and right away she felt she wasn't being respected by the director of photography, the guy in charge of the cameras. He'd roll his eyes at her directions or throw up his hands.
You know, I cried a lot in the hotel room at night, but not on the set. Never on the set.
And then, early in the second week of shooting, it started to rain. Nell got under a small tarp with a camera operator.
And I turn to him and say, "So where are you from?" And he says, "Well, you won't know it. It's Parry Sound, Ontario." And I go, "Bobby Orr's home place?" And he said, "How did you know that?" I grew up loving the Bruins. And he said, "I don't believe you." So I start listing Phil Esposito, Wayne Cashman, Gilles Gilbert, Johnny Busick, Kenny Hodge. And he's like, "Okay, I believe you."
After that, Nell says the camera operator became her secret weapon on set. Whenever she and the director of photography disagreed, he'd help find a compromise. But soon, Nell came up against forces that no amount of Bruin's knowledge could overcome. In 2003, Nell was looking for work. When she and her agent talked about potential shows, her agent would tell her, they've already got two women on staff, so they won't be looking to hire another. At one point, Nell inquired about writing for the show 24. An executive told her they wouldn't hire any women. Nell says the executive told her the show had had a female writer before, and it didn't work out.
That was, quote, the explanation, unquote.
Nell started asking herself bigger questions.
What do I stand for? Do I continue to work in this industry that has huge issues with people of color, with women, or do I speak out? And I chose to speak out.
In 2009, Nell wrote a story for Vanity Fair. It started like this. At this moment, there are more females serving on the United States Supreme Court than there are writing for Late Show with David Letterman, The Jay Leno Show, and The Tonight Show with Conan O'Brien combined. Out of the 50 or so comedy writers on these programs, exactly zero are women. It would be funny if it weren't true. Within 6 months, all three late night shows had hired a female writer. Nell jokes that she helped bring back tokenism. It's like sports gave you the creds to sneak past sort of the guards.
Absolutely.
And then once you got past the guards, you could be the person to report back and say, hey, these are the problems.
Oh, completely. And think about it, standing on the sidelines, the journalist is both an insider and an outsider. And that's how I always felt.
Nell Scovell has continued to fight for gender equality. Recently, she got to meet one of her personal heroes, Gloria Steinem. Steinem had just gotten back from India and was telling Nell horrible stories about the lives of young women there.
And I say to her, you know, I can't believe I care about late night TV when this sort of thing is happening in India. And she touches my shoulder and says, you worry about late night TV, I'll worry about India. And she said it with a smile, and I worry that it sounds glib because it wasn't. And her point was that there are issues of equality everywhere. And if you'll pardon the expression, we need man-to-man defense to fight it. And if what I knew best was late night TV, then it was good to put my energy into that.
This story was produced and reported by Only a Game's Martin Kessler. Nell Scovell's new book is Just the Funny Parts and a Few Hard Truths About Sneaking into the Hollywood Boys Club. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach with help from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal, and our senior producer is Karen Given. We say goodbye this week to intern Dave Sousa. Though no relation to John Philip, he'll be marching on. I'm sorry, Dave. Anyway, good luck. In our final word, Nell Scovell remembers the first joke she ever wrote.
What is the world's smartest dinosaur? And it's Roger's thesaurus. It's a starter joke with training wheels.
She found work in the industry anyways. There's hope for you and for me. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.